Well, tonight is a night of paradox, and of great paradox, as you'll see, and of great beauty, and of great enigma, in which we will be celebrating the extraordinary archetype of modernity as most masterfully presented, depicted, elaborated, and explored by the great Norwegian playwright Henrik Ibsen, who has really, I think, established the template of the modern and the postmodern ego. And this is probably his masterwork, although I think it's rarely performed because it's a play that is written as a poem that I think if you actually did a full reading would be about 5 hours. We're going to be seeing a 39-minute adaptation. And tonight's the movie we're going to see has very little to do with the play by Henrik Ibsen, but enough signifiers of it that it will enable us to relate, I think, to the message and the basic archetypal form that has been installed universally within at least the Western ego starting in the 19th century and the 20th, and much more intensively, perhaps malignantly, in the 21st. So I want to say that this evening I'm making this presentation in honor of Eric, and I want him to come up and speak so we have a real Norwegian voice and perspective about this extraordinary literary event that the writing and the performance and the presentation to the world of this play, Peer Gynt. I don't know if I mentioned the name of the play yet, Peer Gynt. Has brought about, and I want to honor Solveig because Solveig is actually the heroine of this play, and she is the redeemer. It's her love that redeems this totally lost and demonic character. At the end. So I think that we're celebrating love, and we're celebrating the triumph of light over darkness, even in the midst of a hell realm. Even when darkness seems to have been victorious, the light is actually the essential core of the vitality that gives life even to, let's say, the most, I don't want to overuse the word malignant, but that kind of an anti-hero approach to life that Peer Gynt represents, which is what I think is extraordinary, and how it actually also represents Ibsen's own life and his own family system and his own relation to Norway, which he was in exile from for many years, living in Italy, in the same way that Peer Gynt goes on an odyssey and leaves Norway. This is, by the way, Peer Gynt I don't know about how ancient, but a folk tale that Ibsen turned into a play that has, I think, very little relation to the original folkloric Peer Gynt. But I do think it is a very accurate expression of the archetype of the modern and postmodern ego. And I wanted to put this on tonight because it's Sat Prem's last night here also on this visit. And I wanted him to get the benefit of this information that we'll be sharing this evening. But first of all, I want to lower your expectations about what we're going to watch. What we're actually going to see is a high school play, all right? A play made by high school students, literally, in 1941, all right? And although the scene seems to be depicting Norway, it's the U.S., all right? We're not seeing any Norwegian scenery in this film, all right? And mostly it's high school students who are the performers, maybe all of them. And why I think it's an interesting historical archive is the title character, Peer Gynt, is played by a man who went on to make a few other movies, a 17-year-old Charlton Heston. This is his movie debut. Mostly nearly naked, as you'll notice. So, and he played a lot of Peer Gynt-like characters further on in his career. So I think that it has interest in that kind of a sense for cinephiles, but I think the film, oddly enough, captures the essence of the Peer Gynt engram, if you will. And just to give you a little background, it was actually written in 1867, and it wasn't performed until the first time in Christiania, which was the old name for Oslo, until about 1925, when it was de-Christianized. Instead of denazified, the world has been de-Christianized, and starting perhaps in Norway. But Christiania actually was named for King Christian the Fourth, was it, who rebuilt the city after a major fire, and then there was another fire which caused them to have to rebuild again and turn it back into Oslo. So Norway has some issue with fires, and in the future may have some more issues with the Great Fire, but that's a whole other story. Because it's a member of NATO, I think, so it's on the front lines of the power conflict that's now underway and escalating rapidly. So, Peer Gynt was played first in 1876, and the music that you heard was written by Edvard Grieg, the Peer Gynt suite, right? Became a very famous piece of music that has been adapted by many modern musicians, including jazz musicians. There's a number of jazz adaptations, a very famous one by Duke Ellington, in case you're a jazz file. In any case, the reason for Peer Gynt's importance, to my mind, is that for the first time, I think, it presents a nihilistic character who has absolutely no redeeming qualities, who is not only a narcissist, but a psychopath. I mean, let's be honest about this. And has no difficulty committing the worst possible crimes, including murder. He starts out, you'll see in this adaptation, seducing a woman who's about to get married to someone else, and on her actual wedding day, he rapes her and takes her into the mountains and then abandons her. He falls in love with another woman, or does he fall in love? Because he abandons her pretty quickly too. But this woman, Solveig, keeps her love. The other woman, Ingrid, hates him, and what he has done by abandoning her after seducing her is to commit a crime that at that time in Norway would have been hanged in the public square, right? So he was already an outlaw. And then the film becomes very dreamlike, a la Arthur Schnitzler or Hesse's Steppenwolf. And in his wanderings, he ends up seducing another young woman who is the daughter of the king of the trolls, and he is brought into the mountain, inside the mountain where the troll kingdom is, and there he is punished by the troll king because, again, he has gotten this woman pregnant, and then he's about to abandon her, which he does, and he narrowly escapes from this capture. And he is attacked by a creature who, in this adaptation, is not really explained. He's called the Great Boig. I hope you're going to tell us more about the Great Boig. But from my perspective, this is very similar to the Star Trek Great Borg. It's kind of a monstrous internal thought form that takes you over, that turns you into a psychopath. All right, and so the Great Boig, I think, did get into or was already in Peer Gynt, and he was clearly as he was called in the play, more troll than human in his internal psychological structure. He shacks up with Solveig, but he doesn't stay there because, A, he's an outlaw, and, B, he has no object constancy. The guy just cannot be loyal, and so he runs off, and he has to leave Norway because he's now a wanted criminal, and he goes off on his odyssey where he ends up going to places like Morocco and then Egypt and other places where he, in Morocco, he impersonates a businessman and gets involved with all kinds of rich people and does a lot of dealings. But he always ends up losing somehow. And he is likewise seduced by an even more psychopathic woman named Anitra. You'll see her in this adaptation doing, you know, a kind of an Arabic belly dance, but she does a lot more than that in the play. She actually seduces and steals his money and his camel in the middle of the desert and leaves him for dead and takes off. And so... his karma begins to hit the fan. He does finally manage to reach Cairo, where he's put into a mental institution after having a conversation with the Sphinx. And he thinks the Sphinx is another manifestation of the Great Boig. And so they put him into this institution. And in the madhouse, he kind of takes over and he says he's the emperor of the self. Okay, and you know, they buy this, and in a certain way he represents the new archetype of the modern false self. So this he escapes from the lunatic asylum in Cairo and gradually makes his way back to Norway, but he gets on a ship that is shipwrecked in the middle of the ocean, and he's pretty old by this time. And he nearly drowns, but he's holding on to a plank of wood from the ship along with someone else on the ship, and the log won't hold two. And the other guy says, but I have to be saved. My children need me. And he said, well, if you already have children already, you've done with your life. I don't have any kids. And he kills the guy and takes the log, and he survives. So his karma is not exactly pristine, all right? But he arrives back in Norway, and people are talking about Peer Gynt and have, like, legends have already been created about him, but they don't recognize him. But he sort of meets his maker in the form of the button molder, right? This guy who represents the agency that is responsible for melting down souls who have been failures in life. and who have been so defective that they need to be remolded, to be turned into, you know, worthy divine images, right? Because he was just, you know, a mistake somehow. But the problem is that he doesn't believe he's deficient, and so he wants to prove himself. And he says, but he's actually proud of his sins. They are not deficiencies. They're the signs of his individuation. And he has become the total individual that is the Nietzschean Superman. You know, he's not some criminal. He is the one who has gone beyond convention and done it his way and, not been held back by, you know, mere law, you know, and mere goodness or morality or any of that. He's lived to the full, and that's what everyone should do. So he makes a case for himself, which the button molder doesn't quite buy. But the devil even makes an appearance and says, but you know what? His sins aren't even bad enough for me to take him to hell. I don't want him either. Nobody wants the guy. You know, so he finally is about to meet some fate of being, you know, mashed in the divine meat grinder when Solveig sings from her cabin. She's still there waiting for him. And he says to her and to this guy, this button molder that's going to take him and mash him into, protoplasm or bits of divine light, if there's any inside of him. But he calls to her and he says, where have I ever lived as a man, as the man I should have been? Nowhere. When I look back upon my life, I've never lived as the man I should have been. And Solveig says, no, you have in my heart. Ah. And so she has held him as the archetype of the good man. And so because of her love, he is redeemed and he can die in her arms and all is well that ends well. So to me, it's a very strange play. But, you know, Harold Bloom, I think you've all heard of him. He's kind of the arch hierophant of the Western literary canon who critiques everyone and has put Shakespeare basically on the throne. But he says, Peer Gynt is a greater literary character than any other, and that any that Shakespeare ever imagined, greater than Don Quixote, greater than anything done by Tolstoy or Dostoevsky. This is the great literary character and the great achievement. And so, you know, you have to look at that and say, well, in what way, you know, is this greatness? And I think it is because, for all of Harold Bloom's chutzpah in making that, statement, I think that he does represent more accurately the ideal, the hidden, not Jekyll, but Hyde ideal of the modern and postmodern ego that would secretly love to actually lead a life of Peer Gynt and do what he did and get away with breaking the law and being, you know, triumphant and then being redeemed by this woman who waited for him all those years, you know, and he didn't give her anything. And yet he is redeemed after living a totally dissolute life in the sensual realm. And so I think there is a way in which this expression of consciousness in its return to the heart of true love is expressing the final vital link with with the reality that and God consciousness and God as love that ultimately does overcome the darkness in the human soul that the ego has become, and present us with the one point of light that can still guide us home, which is that we are still loved by God unconditionally. That supreme solve of divine love will still accept us back, no matter how defective and sinful we have been, and we are forgiven. And somehow I think that message may be indeed perhaps the highest message and the most necessary for us to receive in this time when all have fallen to such sinful levels that only God's unconditional love could rescue us from our own self-destruction in our disconnect from our divine nature.